Mark, it's David. What kind of blood sport allows for the least amount of motion? You have to follow the ball in golf, Mark. I want something where I don't have to move the camera. Yes, blood sport. I want the combatants to be as still as possible, and I don't want anybody to have any fathomable idea how long of a scene they're in for. Yes. Yes, if there's a possibility for no discernible winner, that is a bonus. Chess has too many pieces. No, that'll remind them of Keaton. No, there needs to be a resolution at the end. And I don't want it to be a foregone conclusion. Baseball moves too much, doesn't it? Yes. Yes, it does. Let's throw it out. Something slow, but with true grit. What kind of sport can you see William Holden playing in a t-shirt? Arm wrestling? Is that a sport? Wait, Stallone? Arm wrestling!
That's great, John.
Yeah, good Lynch impression.
Non-moving blood sport. I like that. And at the end of this episode, when just you and I came on, if I had had your personal cell phone number, I would have given you a call, just so you know.
And what would you have said to John?
Oh, I would have sang the song to him over the phone. That's right, folks. You guessed it. Kindergarten is back in session. Welcome to Sparkwood in 21 Feedback Podcast for Part 13. I am your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
And if you hadn't guessed, this is a No Ship Network podcast.
And what are we doing today? We are reading your feedback. And before we get started, I just want to thank everybody for contributing to our podcast. You guys write amazing letters, and I know it takes time and thoughtfulness to sit down and write these to us. So thank you so much.
Yes, thank you very
like
much.
They're like the fourth members of the podcast, you know, like the three of us and then you guys.
All right. First up, we have Christina. Christina says, hello. I love the podcast. Just started listening a week ago, and I'm already all the way caught up. I'm loving all your theories and knowledge of the show. As someone who is equally Twin Peaks obsessed, I totally appreciate it. I am currently on a lunch break, so I apologize for the quickness of my comment I thought about, which is my theory on Diane. I think it seems way too obvious for us to think of Diane as bad. On all the podcasts I have listened to, no one has really put out that we still don't know why Diane left the FBI in the first place, as well as what made her hold this grudge against the FBI, in the form of saying, fuck you to everyone and their mother, case related. With that, I think there is a much deeper story to be told with Diane. What did Gordon Cole and Albert do to burn that bridge with Diane? Also, I think that Diane is working with who she thinks is Philip Jeffries and thinks that she is texting him and not Mr. C, but Mr. C has somehow hacked the system and tricked her into the coordinates. Interesting.
Yes, I rewatched 8 episodes this past weekend, and I got to see that scene again with Diane and Mr. C from when they were first face-to-face. And once again, I bought it, and I just can't believe that she is working with him.
All right. That's good news.
Well, Paul's Island's Welcome. Getting bigger.
Yeah, well, I don't think Gordon then burnt her. I just think that she has trust issues after meeting Mr. C the first time. Like, maybe she knows that it's not her coup, so she's thinking how many of these other people could have been replaced.
So here's the question, Christina, and to you guys. Do you think that Albert and Gordon don't think that she's working with Coop, but know that she is talking to someone who she thinks might be Philip Jeffries or thinks might be Coop, depending on what's going on? They know that it's not really happening the way she thinks it is, whatever is going on. So they're using her as bait.
Oh, that could be bait for sure. And information. I mean, you know, why let her loose when she's bringing up Las Vegas and they don't know why?
So you kind of get these little hints that drop that maybe make you think that she's going to be pulling a fast one on Cole and Albert, but maybe it's the other way around when the story gets down to the brass tacks of it and she's being used as bait. So.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, then that just supports her scorn for the FBI. I'm with her on that.
Right.
Thank you, Christina.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, thank you, Christina. All right, up next we have Michelle. Michelle says, hi, first just want to say that I love your podcast. It's the only Twin Peaks one I will listen to. I'm a almost lifetime fan of Twin Peaks as I started watching the day it aired when I was 11 years old. So as you can imagine, this new series is like a dream come true. I wanted to write in for the last listener feedback as I have a theory about Audrey, but I missed the deadline. I thought for sure someone else would have wrote in with my same thoughts, but no one did. I think I may have seen one person on the internet with the same idea. Here it is. When I first saw the scene with Audrey, I was frustrated like most people and I couldn't stop thinking about it. It just didn't sit right or feel right. The next morning on my sleep-deprived drive to work, I had an aha moment. She's in a hospital institution type place. Head trauma. That place did not look like a house. Neither of them have wedding rings. He was not about to let her leave that place. Probably her therapist. She was spouting off a ton of names of people that we don't know. I think I've read that head trauma patients do that. She was erratic, very unlike Audrey. She wouldn't leave by herself. Very much unlike Audrey. She was acting like her character and wild at heart more so than like Audrey Horn. Thanks so much for being the best Twin Peaks podcast out there. Can't wait for this week's episode.
Well, thank you.
This is actually what Paul was describing on our recap podcast. So it sounds like you guys have come to the same conclusion.
Yeah, that's awesome. I agree wholeheartedly with you. It definitely feels that way. Thank you for writing in. It's awesome.
Yeah, nice feedback, Michelle. Thank you. So I didn't know head trauma patients did that, just rattled off people's names. That would actually make a lot of sense as to why we're getting all of these new characters thrown at us with no real backstory or context or actually seeing these people, you know, to know that they're actually that they actually exist. So, all right. So thank you for being a first time writer and don't be shy.
Well, I wonder, I mean, this has been going on for 25 years as far as the role playing with Charlie. So there's probably been a lot of world building happening between them if that's the case. So maybe that's where all those names came from as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That would make sense.
Okay. That's a great idea. They have all of this all thought out and it's just part of their game or their story. As it's called. They don't call it a game. They call it a story.
That's a really involved job for Charlie.
Jeez, yeah.
It would cost a lot of money to keep that up, too. So thank goodness she's a Horn.
Yeah, but it's just weird that Ben hasn't mentioned her, even when in reference to Richard Horn, if she is Richard Horn's mother.
Yeah.
It is kind of weird.
Well, it's kind of like out of sight, out of mind type thing, too, though. You know, it's like he was so enthralled by that bicycle and thinking of his dad that it was just kind of like, you know, he gets distracted easily. So he's not the best example of why he didn't mention her. Hence the Civil War aspect of the second season.
Well, at least he's not doing that.
No, thank goodness.
All right, up next we have Chris. Chris says, "Hello, no shippers. I haven't written before, but I have been listening all along through season 3 and have gone back and listened to all your season 1 and 2 podcasts too. I love the detailed recaps and some great theories that your listeners have, and I hoped I could also contribute. Well, welcome aboard the no ship."
Hello, Chris.
Right. There was some strange playing with time in this episode. First, Becky phoned Shelley and said Stephen had been missing for 2 days. Later, Bobby told Ed and Norma that he found things from his dad today. As far as we saw on the show, Becky shot at Stephen the same day as Bobby found the items from his dad, so those scenes appear to be placed in the episode in a weird order. Later in the episode, we have Sarah Palmer's house. She is watching boxing on TV. There is a weird noise, followed by an electricity spark, and TV repeats. And continues repeating over and over again. The same 15 to 20 seconds of footage just on a loop. There was also a strange thing with Audrey. She is still having the same argument with Charlie, presumably on the same night. She can't remember where the roadhouse is or doesn't know how far it is from where she currently is. Maybe she doesn't know where she currently is. Also, look at her reflection in the window after she sits down. It seems very still, barely moves, and almost looks like a younger version of Audrey in the reflection.
I did notice that, but I didn't think about the fact that it was looking still or barely moving. I just thought it looked like a younger version of Audrey.
Ooh, I missed that entirely.
But I thought it's just because there's so much detail lost in that reflection, and that's why. I didn't think it was a purpose thing. But that's after learning about another reflection later. I mean, maybe there's more to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Actually, Chris mentions it as well.
Oh.
Chris goes on to say, "Then jumping to the end, did you notice the final scene as Big Ed was eating soup? If you look closely at the reflection as he is looking out the window, not only does what appears to be the same car drive past multiple times, but Ed's reflection seems to be about 2 or 3 seconds delayed from what he is actually doing. The reflection is him eating the soup, but at the time we see the reflection, he has already put the soup down. This doesn't seem to be just poorly edited, as Ed is in the shot. It seems to have been placed there deliberately. I don't know what all of this means, but something is wrong with time in Twin Peaks." I know theories have been that different stories are running at different points in time, but I think everything is happening concurrently. Vegas, Mr. C, etc. are all running in real time, and Twin Peaks is kind of trapped in a loop of some sorts. Perhaps Twin Peaks is some sort of Brigadoon or Storybrooke-type place. The return is not the return of Cooper, but the return of Twin Peaks itself. Mm-hmm. Ooh. Hope you can discuss this, and it isn't too long. I'd love to hear some theories behind why all this is happening. Thanks, Chris B. P.S. Just as many people turned up at the Roadhouse to watch James Hurley has turned up to watch Nine Inch Nails. Something is definitely wrong in Twin Peaks.
Well, everybody loves a spectacle, first of all.
Yeah.
They're going to show up for this, definitely. And kudos on dropping a Brigadoon drop. I mean, that's impressive.
Yeah, going deep with the references here.
Right? I love that movie.
All right, so to address some of this, another feedbacker had mentioned the Ed Hurley shadow. So we watched it, that scene over right before we podcasted. And you can totally see it. I did not notice the same car driving by multiple times.
Yeah, I need to go back and look for that too.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I thought it was separate cars, but I was playing Love Hurts, so I wasn't paying attention.
So. Well, this is why I thought, and Ed peers out the window at this point. So this time I took it as maybe he was peering at his own reflection and possibly catching what he saw or what we saw in there. But then he seems to kind of process it and move on. Like he doesn't really have a strong emotional reaction is what I mean. That's why I thought he was waiting for somebody because he does peer out the window or at his reflection.
Mm-hmm. Or if Chris is correct, he could be trying to see if maybe he didn't see his own reflection. Maybe he's looking at the cars that were driving by going, did I just see the same car drive by twice? You know, it could be mm-hmm. that too.
Huh.
Now, Paul had noticed something that he saw online right before we went to do this podcast, and it was the scab on Shelley's arm, her right arm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was on Twitter. The cow jumped over the moon, I think, is the person that posted it. And they show close-ups of the scene to where she's in the car with Willy Wonka. What's that guy's name again?
Carl,
thank you. I mean, it's the whistle that gets me. And then the scene where she's in the diner and they show close-ups and she actually has the scab from where she fell off the car on her elbow. So they kind of like prove that that's a later date. You know what I mean?
You know, sometimes I wonder if it's not so much that things are happening out of order in Twin Peaks. They might be. But entertain this notion just for a second. What if Lynch and Frost want us to believe that things are happening out of order, but then when you go back, there's stuff that points you in a different direction if you look carefully enough. Like we all missed the scab, and then it's there. So that shows you that is after the car chase episode, not car chase, but you know the shootout episode. And then what if there's nothing that the Bobby scene though is kind of right now. It's pretty locked up. If he's definitely referring to the stuff that they all found when they went over there with Sheriff Truman and Hawk, then it has to be that day. So that's definitely out of order. And so something's weird about that. But what if we see something later that places it back? You know what I mean? I don't know. It just struck me now as I was talking that, like, what if they want – it's like a misdirection. Like, they want you to start thinking that way, but then really it's not. But I don't know. It's so hard to tell.
Why wouldn't put it past them, you know?
Anyway, interesting stuff all around. Thank you, Chris.
Well,
yeah, thanks, Chris.
I think we have feedback on this, but I think it's also could be thematic that, you know, people in Twin Peaks are stuck in a loop.
Yeah, I think there is something to that. I would definitely agree with that, especially with the Sarah Palmer stuff, as Chris had mentioned.
Yeah, so you've got that where she's at home and there's actually something stuck in a loop on her television screen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the return being like Chris's idea that the return could actually be the return of Twin Peaks to some sort of not necessarily normalcy because we're talking about Twin Peaks here, but possibly returning to a linear timeline to where everything that's happening is happening and everybody can actually move forward. Because all of that evidence kind of fits because even with Big Ed and Norma, they're trapped in a loop too because they're still not together after all this time. And it's like, Jesus Christ, folks, what's going
on? I wonder if that has anything to do with the credits because we used to have where we'd follow like this nice flowing stream. Now we don't even have that anymore. We've got lodge curtains and waterfalls.
Yeah, flashing. It's a lot. Like it starts off at like the 30,000 foot level, as they say, and then it kind of comes down and water smashing against rocks and everything's a little bit chaotic.
Yeah, that's a cool point.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, thank you.
So up next we have Tony, and Tony says, "Hey guys, thanks for indulging my silly theories a couple weeks back. I was wrong on all counts, so it's nearly pointless to make predictions here. Lots of amazing stuff in this episode. That arm wrestling scene reminded me of Jeff Goldblum in The Fly. So is Evil Cooper capable of superhuman strength? That was a big thing in the original series with Nadine Hurley. There was no clear explanation for it that I can recall. I am confused as to the rules of these characters and as to exactly what Mr. C is up to. What is he afraid of, and why did he show up in Montana? I need to start recording these shows because it's hard to remember finer details." Another interesting moment. Bobby tells Ed and Norma that he got some things from his dad today. Does that mean he was in the woods with Truman and Hawk already? Is Lynch now going to tease us about what they found? It seems like we're not going to get a scene at Jackrabbit's Palace. First time I thought he was talking about the messages in that tube thing, but that was at least a few days back, and the gun incident at the diner happened at night in part 11. The diary pages appear to have been another red herring, and they haven't been mentioned since part 7. Richard Horne is super confusing now that the Audrey story seems to be on a separate track. I'm really not quite sure what to make of his character, but he was quite taken with Bad Cooper. I will make no attempt at guessing, but I'm quite sure they will have an important encounter before all this is over. Maybe a father-son reunion? See you in the trees, Tony.
I just see Mr. C grabbing Richard Horne and giving him like a noogie, you know, like, come here, what are you doing?
It'd be opposite from Dougie and his son, too. They'd be like throwing the ball maliciously at each other, trying to make it hurt.
They're not playing catch or throw, they're playing draw. They just draw guns.
Pain.
So it sounds like, Tony, you're just believing that this is all Lanier.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of in his camp, too, you know, but I don't know. There's just... It's hard to tell. And don't feel bad about not getting any of your theories right. I mean, it's just how it is. You know, we all go through it.
Oh, yeah. We excel at it here at Notion Network. Yeah. We just throw some stuff out there. I pride myself on, you know, coming up with a theory and standing behind it for that whole 45 minutes and then having it just be blown out of the water. It's kind of fun.
Exactly.
As to your question about you're confused as to the rules of these characters and to what exactly Mr. C is up to. What is it he is afraid of, and why did he show up in Montana? I think Mr. C is trying to, he's after the coordinates because it's going to get him to a place he wants to go to. I don't know what he's going to find there or what he thinks he's going to find there. And I don't know that he's necessarily afraid of anything, but he's wary of whatever Philip Jeffries is trying to do because Philip Jeffries, or the person pretending to be Philip Jeffries at any rate, is trying to maneuver him back into the lodge. And that's the last place he wants to be. He wants to be out forever. So
yeah, because if Diane texted the coordinates to Philip Jeffries, we're assuming that Mr. C has hacked that and has also got the coordinates, right?
Yes.
So why would he still need the coordinates from Ray? Unless he's trying to trip the trap, or what is it? How do you say that? Trigger the trap?
Spring the trap. Yeah. Either way. Yeah.
It could be.
Spring the trap.
Or he's trying to verify, you know, you have more information from more than one source and they all match up, then you know, okay, these people couldn't possibly know each other. So it's got to be the correct coordinates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would want to do that too, kind of like a redundancy, just to have the coordinates on your phone and then to have a physical copy and be like, okay, how, like you said, they couldn't know each other, so how could
maybe
it?
He wants to avoid the coordinates. We haven't thought of that either. Maybe he's trying to not go.
Oh.
Like he wants to know where it's at, but maybe he sends some goons instead because he doesn't want to get trapped back in the lodge, keep Bob inside of him safe. I don't know.
To answer your question, I also think Mr. C does have superhuman strength, and it was on display here with the punch in the face and the arm wrestling. But I think, like we also talked about and M pointed out with the twist his arm off, you know, the cheerleading from the evolution of the arm that he got. Dougie also has this strength. He just hasn't used it yet aside from that one scene. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one clear rule about these characters. There are no rules.
I had joked on the recap how maybe this is leading up to a boxing match between Dougie Coop and Mr. C. And it would be so great if the arm is like Mickey from Rocky.
Oh, that'd be amazing. I would watch an hour of that.
It would be the arm, and he'd also have Bushnell in his corner, battling Bud. That's who.
Yeah, you can actually
him.
Get some training. Yeah.
Well, we hope we made everything crystal clear, so now you understand exactly what's going on. Thank you, Tony.
I think they're still going to go to Jackrabbit's Palace.
Oh, yeah, me too. I hope so. I'll be pissed if they don't.
I mean, we got to figure out what the hell Jerry's up to, right? And I think he's heading that way as well. There's going to be a convergence or
yeah,
something.
Plus the Dutchman, whatever that is. So
we've got feedback on that.
Sweet. I was hoping for that.
All right. Thank you, Tony.
Up next is Ryan. Hello, no shippers. This one's popular tonight. I like it. It has been a while since I've been able to write in. Life has a way of throwing up roadblocks. But man, did I like this episode. As before, I'll be brief as possible because all of my salient points relate to one particular scene. Sonny Jim playing on his new gym set. Number one, music. Since music is so important to Lynch and his choices are always deliberate, it stood out to me that a version of Tchaikovsky's Swan Theme from Swan Lake, a non-Badalamenti piece, made its way into this scene. What's important about that piece is that it is used in different variations throughout the ballet to signify different characters and events. Most notably, it is used in relation to Odette the Swan Princess, dressed in white, and Odile, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, the daughter of the magician who cursed Odette and her handmaids to be swans, depicted in most productions as the Black Swan. Odile is made to look like and poses as Odette in an effort to seduce the hero, Siegfried. So right away, you have a musical piece used in the show that signifies a black and white lodge, duality, as well as the doppelganger aspect. 2. Connection to Wagner. Also, Swan Lake has themes that are very similar to a certain Wagner opera, The Flying Dutchman. If you recall, Ray told Mr. C that Jeffries was located at the Dutchman. I don't think that this was just a cool-sounding throwaway. I think Lynch Frost are dropping subtle clues for us by referring to two pieces that may be more Peakian than we thought. 3. Connective themes between Swan Lake and The Flying Dutchman. A very similar theme runs through both Swan Lake and The Flying Dutchman. Love and sacrifice that together break a curse. In Swan Lake, rather than break his vow in order to save his life, Siegfried and Odette choose their love, jump into the lake, and drown. Their self-sacrifice slash love for one another then breaks the curse upon the other swan maidens, transforming them back into human form, and then the two lovers ascend into the heavens in an apotheosis. In The Flying Dutchman, Senta learns of the Dutchman's curse but pledges to remain faithful to him forever. When he leaves, forever bound to sail the seas, Senta, after swearing her devotion and faithfulness, drowns herself in the ocean. These acts of love and sacrifice break the curse upon the Dutchman. His ship disappears, he is freed of his magical bondage, and then both Senta and he ascend into the heavens. What does all of this mean? Who knows? But here's my thought. Cooper and Laura are bound, not by romantic love, but platonic love rooted in their inherent goodness and the tragedy of 25 years ago. Laura is apparently not truly dead, and Cooper is definitely alive. I think that maybe the end game is this. Cooper and Laura both, quote, awaken in Twin Peaks, and after returning Mr. C to the lodge, will sacrifice themselves out of a mutual love for one another, 2, the people of Twin Peaks, and 3, for the world at large. They vow to end the darkness and willingly die, a la Laura in 25 years ago, to stop it. The combination of their death and love will dispel the dark magic used by the Mother Bob Black Lodge woodsman once and for all, banishing it all forever to where it came from. Cooper and Laura then ascend and take their places alongside the giant Dido, Mike, and the evolved arm, possibly others, as Desonans and some extra-dimensional space ever watchful against the appearance of malignant threats. Just a thought that came to me when I was thinking about this episode and some of the stills that emerged from the sets during filming. Oh, and Von Rothbart, the sorcerer in Swan Lake, takes the form of a giant owl and two acts. So I guess it is true that owls are not what they seem. Thanks, y'all. Ryan.
Well, damn. That's wow. The podcast for tonight. We'll see everybody later. That was really well put, man.
That actually clears up a lot if you're wondering, right? You know, not clears up, but it brings new information that helps you understand.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like his options for how it ends. I would be fine with any of 1, 2, or 3. It's really good. It'd be a good, like, Return of the Jedi end moment if they kind of appear, you know, with all of them. It'd be fantastic.
Could be a fourth option where nothing happens because David Lynch and Mark Frost doesn't think the world deserves it.
Yeah, or the world ends. Oh, that would be glorious, too.
And you just have Cooper banging his head against a window or a mirror saying, how's the audience? How's the audience?
The world is on fire and the mother is just vomiting out creatures over everything. Oh, that would be a great comic book too.
So I like the idea of both of these plays having apotheosis in them, meaning ascending to like a godlike stature, if I remember correctly. So if Cooper and Laura could be tending that way, that I mean that would be a great ending for this if they did sacrifice themselves like that.
Yeah,
and absolutely.
And it's very Christ-like, and Laura already has that shades of Christ-like about her with the giant passing her in a way to where she's going to be our savior, or at least it's implied. And then with her saying, "I'm dead, but yet I live."
Right. I didn't even think about that.
Jesus Christ pose.
Thank you, Ryan.
Yeah, and thank you.
Anything else you wanted to say about that?
Nope.
Thank you for going into a lot of detail about the Flying Dutchman and Swan Lake. We have more about the Dutchman here soon. But first, we've got Duffy. Duffy says, hey, Spark Witties.
This episode was so good, it gave me a Spark Witty.
It's become increasingly clear throughout The Return that David Lynch has been filling the show with connections and references to his entire body of work. This has got me thinking, I'm starting to wonder if the whole inner reality of the show has been slowly folding in on itself, much like an Inland Empire. Charlie's and Sarah's references to the story seem to be strangely meta. The way time is working within the show feels increasingly hazy and nonlinear, not just that we are being shown events out of sequence. Anyway, I could go on, but I'll spare you my stoned ramblings. A couple other Lynch connections. The weird foghorn sounds during the Rancho Rosa opening are heard in the background of Rabbits, Lynch's unsettling web series that ended up as part of Inland Empire. Also, I think it's significant that Dougie lives in Rancho Rosa, a clear break in the fourth wall. Just saying. Sunny Jim's amazing and surreal gym set scene really reminded me of the other Lynch Frost show from the 90s, The All But Forgotten On the Air, which you haven't seen, well, whoa, it's on YouTube. Set absurdity filters to maximum. The conga line that opened part three was also very on the air, and perhaps a little like the ending of Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal, which could also say something about the nature of Dougie's storyline and where it could be heading. Anyway, thanks again. You guys are my favorite Peaks podcast. Really makes me feel like I have friends to talk about this stuff with. Besides, my cat, she stopped watching after part eight. P.S. she says, I can't stop thinking about Phyllis Hastings. How did she know Mr. C? Why did the screen glitch when he shot her? How did she follow human nature perfectly? When Bill Hastings was being questioned by Agent Preston, why did the people in the zone yell, what's your wife's name? What's your wife's name? At him. What's the deal with Phyllis Hastings? Forgot about the fact that they yelled that at him. That is really weird.
Yeah, why the hell would they do that? Yeah, we dealt with all that after that episode, and man, it feels like such a long time ago now when all that stuff happened.
You know, one thing I thought when I did the rewatch and I watched that weird glitch when Phyllis Hastings gets shot, I was wondering maybe because she was killed by Mr. C, maybe she was removed from multiple timelines.
That's cool. I like that.
Maybe that's also why we see Ray dead in the lodge as well as terrestrially, because he was shot by Mr. C.
Okay.
Right? That's pretty cool.
And if we're going to take it even further, when Bill Hastings dies in the back of the car, in the back of Mackley's car, he shifts a little bit too. So he could be coming back into all of his timeline, or coming back from all of his timelines, or dying in all of his timelines.
He shifted, or was there just like a shimmer over
it? Was
him?
Like a shimmer. But then we kind of attributed that, which I feel probably is the more correct way to look at it, to the woodsman passing in front of him. Mm-hmm. So that like your line of sight sees it like as a heat image kind of thing. So that probably makes more sense.
But as to why that these people that were confronting Bill Hastings in the zone, asking him, what's your wife's name? Maybe that was Mr. C.
Yeah.
But still, there's got to be more to it than just it's Mr. C and he's been banging your wife. Like, I don't know.
I get to see like the conversation. Why did you need the wife's name? Because she's hot, Ray.
Well, we can't answer any of your questions. Sorry, Duffy.
Yeah, sorry, Duff.
We tried, kind of, but
yeah.
Kind of got stuck in a loop on that one. Duffy also has a brief addendum, and she says, okay, guys, crazy theory. The giant is the Dutchman. Carl Storken is Dutch. A huge stretch, I know, but this could explain why his name has been obscured in the credits. This could explain the whole interaction between Mr. C and Ray right before Ray is killed. Too obvious or too out there? I have no clue. Duffy, I like that.
Mm-hmm. If that's the case, then that's why he shot Ray, because he's like, God damn it. I'm not going to see that guy.
No, exactly. You
know, that's a dead end for him. He's just like, crap.
And maybe it angered him to know that he was involved as well. And that's why he pulled the trigger out of anger.
I think he shot him. I mean, it felt like to me like he shot him before he tried to give up more information on what the Dutchman was, especially when other people are watching. But then again, he's also like, well, I don't know what it is. And he's like, bang, I do. I don't know. I thought the Dutchman was a restaurant in like Nova Scotia or something, but yeah, who knows?
Yeah, it sounds like a who pub knows? Or something, but he doesn't say, I know where that is. He says, I know what that is.
Exactly. I like the idea that Duff's proposed. I think it's great.
Thank you, Duffy.
Thanks, Duffy. All right, up next we have Kenny. Kenny says, hi guys, a late thought regarding Diane's bar scene in part 12. Although she is entering coordinates, noun, into her phone, she pronounces it as the verb form. A quick Google search brought up this definition: bring the different elements of a complex activity or organization into a relationship that will ensure efficiency or harmony. Could this indicate, contrary to Mike's assertion that one of the three Coopers must die, that Dale, Dougie, and Doppel Cooper will instead be brought together? Perhaps Diane has a part to play in uniting our beloved Agent Cooper with the other two versions of himself. Loving the podcast. Keep up the great work.
I like that. Harmony would be great. In fact, that's what we need. The glitchiness is not harmonious.
Mm-hmm.
It's anti-harmony. So it would be the antidote.
Ah, the antidote.
Booyah.
Thanks for that, Kenny. That's awesome.
Thank you, Kenny.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, I like that idea. Up next is Shayna. And Shayna says, oh, her subject's Twin Peaks, the machete edit. And she says, dear Sparkwood Trio, please excuse my typos as I'm typing this on my phone while drinking a celebratory Michelada after escaping the purgatory that is the New York Passport Agency. Kids, do yourselves a favor and check your passport's expiration date today.
No.
That sounds like you had a bad day.
Oh, yeah.
On to part 13. I'm a Sherlockian, so I'm familiar with the fun a fandom can have with an unclear chronology. I'm looking forward to the inevitable debates among Twin Peaks fans over what order the parts of the return should be watched and or how the scenes should be re-edited. I'm pretty sure that Becky's call to Shelley and Bobby's solo dinner at the Double R in this episode happened before Becky's rampage and the subsequent family conference at the diner. Likewise, Sunny Jim and Cooper's game of catch in part 12 makes no sense if it actually occurred between the Mitchum brothers' desert rendezvous with Dougie and their arrival at Lucky Seven, but it does if it precedes both. Sidebar, kudos to Tom Sizemore, whose oh shit face at the conga line may be the funniest moment of the season thus far. Now I'm wondering if Richard Horn fled to Montana after killing that kid, or if Mr. C's arm wrestling match actually preceded or even instigated a chain of events that led to that tragedy. The Audrey in a coma theory gained some weight. What's the deal with her husband, Charlie, no last name? Are Lynch and Frost going full meta and adding a capital A author to the mix? Final thoughts. What did Big Ed burn? And best Roadhouse act ever. Cheers. P.S. I did type Paul when I meant Steve last week. Sorry. Didn't proofread before sending.
We knew it. We knew it.
It's okay.
Dang it.
It's happened before.
I think Ed was burning a book of matches, wasn't he?
That's what I thought too.
Not a whole book.
No, just the front flap. It looked like he ripped the front flap and was just burning it.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I think a lot of people... have been thinking about Becky's call to Shelley and Bobby's solo dinner at the Double R in this episode and thinking that it happened before. And after looking at some of the evidence, I think we're now kind of divided because as we talked about in other pieces of feedback already this evening, Shelley has the scab on her right elbow that she had when she was with Carl after getting thrown from the hood of the car when Becky was stealing it to go look for Steve. Mm-hmm. But we don't have that aha moment for Bobby and saying they found some stuff at my dad's house today. So kind of divided. One of them looks like it's linear. The other one looks like it's could be wishy-washy, you know, could be timey-wimey.
It's too bad Bobby didn't go into depth of what they found. Like when they went to their own booth, I would rather listen to that conversation than... Oh, the one that happened in the other booth.
Yeah, I would have too. Talking about pie ingredients and, you know, I mean, I understand the purpose of it because we're supposed to understand that Twin Peaks is being infiltrated by these outside influences that corrupted everywhere else in the world. And now they're coming here too, to our beloved little town. But I really would have wanted to hear that other conversation. You know, whatever.
Yeah, Bobby probably
about.
Went into detail about going into his room, taking a part of the chair off, finding a Playboy that he stashed. It might have been going on between the two of them all through the house, you know, like, oh, I got a secret compartment too.
And after about 5 minutes in, Bobby would realize that Ed's not even listening to him, that he's just scowling across the way at Norma.
Oh, yeah, mumbling under his breath, that motherfucker. Fucking.
Somebody said that Ed, with his haircut, looks like the Grinch.
That was Holly on our...
Yeah. That was Holly?
That was Holly on our Facebook page.
And once... Yeah, now every time I see it, especially when he's making those faces, and you're just like, oh, you're a mean one, Mr. Ed.
Doodle-doo-doo. Oh, Mr. Ed.
No. Why I'm the telling long you, face? He's brooding. Love hurts.
And as far as Richard Horn fleeing before or after killing that kid to Montana, or if maybe if this took place prior, that's an interesting idea that I would have never, it would, that never occurred to me.
Yeah.
Like maybe he's introduced to Red somehow through this group involving Mr. C. And then we get that scene later if there is timey-wimey stuff going on.
Yeah, or Red told him about this place.
It fits too easily, though, to have him flee Twin Peaks because of all this shit that was going down and then to end up here as kind of like a safe place.
I agree with that.
So that's why I would say that that's... To me, that doesn't seem to fit, but...
After Mr. C leaves, a day goes by, then Red shows up and causes another ruckus. You know, they're like, fuck. Like, the biggest, baddest people in the Northwest are just all coming to this place and finding someone. I told you I was going to pop your head off. Because you know he's not paying them. Now he probably flooded with the dope and the money.
Oh, yeah. He's in trouble.
Mm-hmm. If he's not working for Red. If Red's not a bigger boss for all this. So, and it's possible, but I don't think he is. So, I didn't even think about that till now. It'd be interesting to see how it pans out.
You know, he could have been looking at Mr. C so intently because he's like gonna try to approach him later and be like, hey, how much money would it take for you to take out this guy I know called Red? You think you could do this for me?
Yeah, well, Red's working for Mr. C for sure with the weirdo magic trick he's got. He's probably like, here's the dime he left in your mouth, kid, and walk off. Mic drop.
Thank you, Shana.
All right, up next, Shannon. Hello, No Shippers. Like many of your feedbackers, this is my only Twin Peaks outlet. None of my friends or my family watch the show. My husband and a few friends tried but couldn't get into it. I'm so thankful for this wonderful fan community you have developed. I so look forward to hearing the reactions of the three of you and the No Ship after the episode airs each week. I wanted to wait until I listened to this week's recap episode before I sent this, however. My husband and I are about to embark on our first week-long road trip, and I didn't want to miss the deadline. Our first stop is Las Vegas, and I already warned my husband I might have to channel Dougie and play a slot machine just so I can say, hello!
Oh, you better do that.
Hell yeah, that's awesome.
That is a must. Sorry if any of this is repeating ideas you three have already discussed on the main episode this week. I love the idea brought up last week about the dirt gnomes, or Leland being at the house with Sarah in episode 12. I was getting a strong Bob vibe with the ceiling fan on and her darkened demeanor. The thing that struck me was the color of her hair. It looked lighter in the store just a few scenes before. It was more of a dirty blonde shade. During the scene with Hawk at the house, her hair looks darker to me. I rewatched both scenes thinking I missed something. Maybe it's just the lighting differences, but it really looked darker. Did anyone else notice this?
I'd have to go do a comparison.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't even see it myself.
I think I thought her hair looked really gray, like Bob's, actually, when Hawk was there, but... I need to go back and look. That's how it looks in my memory.
Watching Sarah Palmer in this week's episode trapped in her loop of drinking and smoking on repeat, just like the boxing match on her TV kept repeating, reminded me of the scene with her earlier in the season when she was watching the nature documentary. I thought that's not Sarah. I started wondering if all of the drinking isn't a way to numb her grief. If anyone is entitled to do so, it's her. But a way to suppress Bob and the darkness, much like Laura did in Fire Walk With Me. On a brighter note, Paul, I'm with you on the Diane is Innocent Island.
All right.
Like a few feedbackers mentioned last week, it just seems too obvious that they are showing us Diane watching everything and making us think she is working for Evil Coop for it to be true. I really believe her reaction to Evil Coop in the jail room scene was real. That was true fear and anger. Coupled with her constant need to drink and smoke, I feel like Diane is a shell of the woman she once was, just like many of the residents of Twin Peaks we saw this week. Poor Big Ed and Audrey. Mm-hmm. I think Diane is working with Philip Jeffries and that he is the secret billionaire. I don't have a completely polished version of this theory, but I wanted to throw it out there as little things are adding up for me. Based on the strange conversation Evil Coop had with, quote, Philip Jeffries earlier in the season, and that Jeffries set up everything for Ray to take out Evil Coop by giving him a gun and the owl cave ring with instructions on how to use it, he seems to have a pretty good handle on where Evil Coop is, what he is up to, and how to send him back to the lodge. You are not alone on the island, Paul. Can't wait to hear all of your thoughts on this week's episode and the community feedback. Thanks again for your hard work. I'm off to find Mr. Jackpots. Shannon.
All right. Good luck. And welcome to the island. We just went from like a little tent on the beach to maybe a hut. It's nice.
I'm starting to get crowded on this island.
It's good. Yeah. It's good. Welcome.
I should say on that island because I'm not on it. So
you're not?
No. Mm. I mean, I'm in like, you know, lifeboat distance.
Oh no. You're either on or off the island. Right. It's like Lord of the Flies over here.
I agree with what you're saying about Sarah, though. I should say it this way. I like what you're saying about Sarah. She's not drinking to numb her grief, but to keep Bob down. Mm-hmm. Maybe she's figured out the perfect Bloody Mary will keep him just underneath enough to where he can't spring up. And that's why she's constantly drinking. Hopefully her liver can handle it.
Which we've had somebody before bring that up and compared it to like Mike taking the haloperidol.
Although you would think on the, just from a glance, you would think that alcohol would make it easier with the lowering of inhibitions and all that kind of thing. So who knows?
Yeah. And I mean, didn't Bob corrupt Laura and encourage that kind of behavior from her?
Yeah.
He wanted to live through her. So maybe that's actually what's going on with Sarah.
Hmm.
Maybe she's drinking to forget what she's doing.
Are we going to see Sarah working at One Eye Jack's? The perfume counter.
Okay, that works.
Yeah.
Well, that's just the beginning.
That's where you start.
Thank you, Shannon.
Thanks, Shannon.
Mm-hmm.
Up next, we have Tina. And Tina says, hello, Steve, Paul, and Em. It's Tina, who decided to take a break after part 12 and didn't write as I've done in past weeks. I'm afraid I was so angered by most of that part. The thoughts I discussed with others of like mind were too all over the place for your broadcast, and I fear whatever I might have put in an email would have been distorted ramblings as I vented. I'm calmer when it comes to 13, and while it wasn't perfect, I did walk away partially intrigued, partially stunned. As always, I apologize if you've covered much of this in your broadcast, since I will be emailing you before it airs. I'll get this off my chest first. I almost burst a spleen as James warbled through a song I hated when he sang it back in the day. The only thing missing was Bob crawling across tables and chairs to put an end to it. But Bob was probably running for the hills. It was laughable enough hearing the James has always been cool line back in episode 1 or 2 or whenever it was. Now we get further trolled by him singing with a backup group I expected to morph into Maddie and Donna. Top the whole mess off with the girl weeping in the booth as if she's witnessing the Beatles at Shea Stadium back in the 60s. I couldn't stop laughing. I don't appreciate being trolled with James any more than I would a reappearance of Jar Jar Binks in a future Star Wars movie. Oh God, I need a bourbon shot after that thought.
Dark Jar Jar is always good around.
Now to important matters. When I first saw Audrey in episode 12, I was struck by how much she reminded me of Elizabeth Taylor in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. On a side note, a fellow Twin Peaks fan told me Sherilyn actually played Miss Taylor in a biographical movie not long after Twin Peaks went off the air. IMDb lists Ray Wise in the role of director Mike Todd, Taylor's husband who died in a tragic plane crash. But I digress. Audrey's screeching and cursing reminded me of Taylor in Virginia Woolf so much, a play and movie about a marriage crumbling from the get-go, and where a husband and wife seem to delight in destroying one another, taking turns in belittlement and soul-crushing dialogue. Of course, the great Richard Burton was physically nothing like Charlie, but when Charlie turns the tables on Audrey in part 13 with his disturbing threats, it was similar to the Burton character, George, doing the same to Liz's Martha before getting bested in return. I don't know if you all have seen the movie version. If you haven't, it should be on your must-watch list. Taylor and Burton are incredible. Someone on the Twin Peaks Reddit forum also mentioned Virginia Woolf, but it had nothing to do with any Audrey-Charlie comparison. It had to do with a spoiler towards the movie's climax. I hate dropping the spoiler, and I promise it won't ruin your enjoyment of the film, but this is where it ties into Twin Peaks. Burton and Taylor have rampaged all night, even in the movie, to Taylor wanting to get further liquored up at the Roadhouse. At some point in their marriage, the couple had created an imaginary son which has helped them hold on to their train wreck of a relationship, but the imaginary son is never to be mentioned to anyone outside their circle of two. During the movie, when Taylor talks to others about the son returning home for his 21st birthday, Burton ends the story by informing her that the son was killed in a car accident on the way there. The make-believe son ceases to exist, and a semblance of reality is restored. The imaginary son's name, Sonny Jim, which is why the Reddit commenter referenced Virginia Woolf. So I'm back to the belief Sonny Jim Jones is the figment of someone's imagination. The Jungle Jim was otherworldly with Swan Lake playing in the background, while Sonny Jim appears to repeat the same actions as if caught in a loop. And the spotlight, the giant used to get one. Bob got one too, as did poor Maddie. Anyway, if Sonny Jim and Janie E die in a car accident while swerving to miss a porcupine, such as a la Virginia Woolf, I'm going to smile and hand it to Frost and Lynch for taking a text from one of the greatest of American plays. Finally, this episode contains Hitchcockian styled moments which ramped up the creep level. No, not James's singing. Sorry. It was waiting for something or someone to stroll into Sarah Palmer's TV room, but nothing does. It was thinking something felt very off about the camera shots with Big Ed sitting alone at his business. If you all have already discussed this moment, forgive me, but you know what I'm going to say. If you haven't discussed it, you need to go back and rewatch the scene when the camera aims towards the front of the business from Big Ed's point of view. I was already bothered that the business suddenly reminded me of the infamous Part 8 convenience store. Something was off. I wasn't sure what. When the camera aims at Big Ed burning that piece of paper or whatever it was, my thanks to Reddit for grabbing this 10 to 12 seconds. Go back to where he's looking out towards the pumps and the cars driving by. Look to the left-hand side window pane between the pumps until you catch his reflection. And that's all I'll say. Once you see it, you're going to replay it again and again to make sure your eyes aren't playing tricks. I think my eyes caught it during my first viewing, but my mind was still processing it, and that's why it didn't feel right. This is the sort of subtlety I like in a tension-filled scene. I was half expecting a woodsman to sneak by. Instead, we get what we witness, which is much more menacing. That's it for now. And who knew? The Nine Inch Nails were James Hurley's opening act. James Hurley's opening act. Wonders never cease. Tina. So awesome. Yes, I've actually seen Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf many times, but I'm ashamed that I didn't catch the Sonny Jim reference and the Roadhouse reference. Like, I never made that connection.
M had me watch it once years and years ago, and I vowed to never watch it again because it was just harrowing if you've ever seen it. I mean, and it's a testament to how good Burton and Taylor do in the movie.
I'll have to check it out. I've never seen it.
Be prepared. It's a roller coaster. By the end of it, you're going to be like, Jesus Christ, what did I just watch?
Awesome.
But it is worth it. It is worth it. It's something that you want to have a watch of under your belt just as an American, I think.
Yeah,
and somebody who's into movies at all. You know, it's. I'm glad that I've seen it. I just may not be revisiting it. I'm with you there, Tina. Big Ed's gas barn or gas farm did remind me of the original convenience store, too. That initial shot going in, it just from Part 8. So, but yeah, we talked about it on an earlier piece of feedback. Once you see that, it's like, what does that mean? What's the importance of that? Why is his shadow moving and him not? Which the best explanation for it is it's not like doing some sort of weird dance or anything like that. It's doing the same movements he just did, but it's however many seconds removed. So who knows? But it does lend credence to the whole idea of there being some sort of loop. And then when people get close to coming out of it, maybe there's some weirdness that goes on, like when you're passing through the permeable barrier of dimensions or something. I don't know.
No, I like it. It seems to be happening mostly at night too, doesn't it?
Seems like it, yeah. All right, up next is Dominic. Dominic says, hey, Steve, Paul, and Em, this is my first time writing in to you fine folks, so allow me to begin with the necessary platitudes. You know shippers are fans after my own heart. I adore your podcast, and I'm so grateful to get the chance to take advantage of this outlet you have graciously provided, albeit a little late to the part. First, I'd like to share my pre-peak week's ritual, and in order to do that, I will take you back to 1989. I am 3 years old, and it is a typical Saturday morning. I have poured myself a gigantic bowl of sugary cereal, surrounded myself with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles action figures, and I'm watching my favorite Heroes in a Half Shell on TV. Old habits die hard, I suppose.
So that's like pre-Peaks, literally, before Twin Peaks ever even aired. This is what Dominic was doing.
Except instead of cereal, I cut myself a huge slice of pie and enjoyed my favorite show with my Twin Peaks action figures, pictured below, in hand. I see them as a totem guiding me into a world both wonderful and strange. I have to say, now I got myself wanting a Twin Peaks cereal, crispy, crunchy petroglyphs with owl pie and log-shaped marshmallows, a cute little cartoon of the evolved arm on the box. Available now for a limited time. Get them before they're non-existent.
Oh, that's awesome.
I digress. I'm not sure who I am, but I'm not me. Truer words have never been spoken thus far in The Return, and they keep playing over and over again in my head. How could people be disappointed with Audrey's reintroduction? Her scenes thus far have gotten all my wheels turning, and that is Lynch and Twin Peaks at their best.
Agreed.
You thought you were getting to get that innocent girl dancing in a trance to moody music. Well, think again. It's mindfuck time. Something is very wrong with our Audrey. She is sans confidence, sans independence, and it is truly frightening and compelling stuff, just to have to see how they, quote, end her story. Lastly, James has always been cool, obviously, and I don't think I have laughed as hard as I did during that Roadhouse musical guest. Absolute brilliance in its simultaneous earnestness and absurdity. That girl was bawling her eyes out to James and his awkward, butt-puckering falsetto.
Maybe she was crying because of how bad it was.
Yeah, it's possible. Maybe she was possessed by Bob, and the song, as mentioned before, drove Bob away, and she was crying with relief. I feel like myself again.
So we figured out why James Hurley is significant. He's an exorcist.
Oh, geez. To me, that was Lynch's direct commentary on the phenomenon of show revivals in general and being a tourist in your own nostalgia. Ooh, that's interesting. Here is James Hurley going through the same motions he did 25 years ago, and you can't help but feel like it's a joke. Everyone who wanted the beats of season 1 and 2 followed in The Return should take note of that scene. We are seeing something we have never seen before. The show that reinvented television is doing it all over. It is truly happening again. Dom.
Yes, I like your idea for that cereal. That needs to be a thing that I can buy and eat.
Mm-hmm. And cut out the front of it so you can paste it on the wall.
Let's see.
Oh, for sure.
Thank you, Dominic. Thank you for joining our feedback podcast. And up next, we have Rachel. Or Rachel wrote in actually another letter that was talking about Vikings. And Rachel, I hope that you join us for our Vikings podcast as well. You would fit right in, especially with you being a history major. We would love to have your feedback for the upcoming Vikings season. But we're going to go ahead and listen to what Rachel has to say about this Twin Peaks episode. And she says, "It was a dream. We live inside a dream," Philip Jeffries exclaimed, "and fire a walk with me. Admittedly, this probably wouldn't come to mind if I hadn't watched it recently, but it seemed to resonate throughout this episode. Is Dougie Coop in a dream? Another realm? Limbo? Clearly there is something larger at play here with the ease of his escape from lethal situations. A cherry pie saves his life. He snaps too long enough to fend off Ike the Spike with superhuman strength. The sharpshooter misses him in the Jeep because he bends to pick up his dropped key. Anthony Sinclair can't kill him because... Is he trapped in the same or similar space as Audrey? Where is Audrey anyway? Is she in a coma? Between lodges? Or just mentally ill? She feels like someone else, somewhere else. Charlie admonishes her, asking if he has to end her story too. And with those few words, he morphed from benign to menacing. I definitely think there are some interdimensions and or dream state at play here. Timelines seem to be shifting, not quite matching up, and time itself seems circular and fluid rather than linear and fixed. Bobby mentions finding his dad's stuff earlier that day. Exactly how much time has passed since Sheriff Truman said they would venture to Jackrabbit's Palace in 2 days' time? Sarah Palmer watches a boxing match on a loop with a crackle of electricity. Is she trapped within a time loop that encompasses the town, her home, her mind, or all of the above? A few random thoughts. I believe Richard Horne recognized Mr. C as his father. I've completely bought into this theory. Why would Mr. C need the coordinates from Ray when Diane already has them? Paul, I'm trying. Why did we get James and that crappy ass song back before Cooper? Why? I cringed as a 10-year-old when it originally aired. Looking back, I was probably a bit too young to be watching Twin Peaks, but compared to stuff on now, it's pretty tame. The fact that Lynch and Frost did that to me is just low, which is how I feel in a world without Cooper. I have mentioned I want Cooper back, right? And one last thing. How in the hell does Shelley waitress in heels? If you need me, I'll just be over here begging Mike to put the owl ring on James before he can torture any more hapless souls. Yeah, Shelley is wearing red heels, isn't she?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's even worse than Tammy wearing them, because Tammy at least can sit down and have breaks and whatever, where waitresses are on their feet all day long.
Skills. That's what she's got, skills.
Yeah, that's all it takes to walk comfortably around in high heels is skills.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's impossible. When I wear my heels, my feet last an hour tops.
Yeah, those with your Mariah Carey cut off.
Exactly, the white ones.
I just have this this picture in my head of somebody running up from the Roadhouse crowd, putting the petroglyph ring on James Hurley and then shooting him.
Bow!
And then everybody cheers, yeah! And then Mike is going to deal with him for eternity.
Just you and I.
Sung all backwards and weird.
Instead of...
Don't die. He's like, don't sing. Don't sing.
Pulls the ring off him and shoots him and sends him back.
Don't sing. All right. Up next is Daniel. Daniel says, hey, no shippers. Let's go back to starting position. I do find it funny the way Lynch and Frost have clearly been enjoying teasing those viewers who, like viewers of the original series wanting to know who killed Laura Palmer, long for the Cooper they remember to return. These fans have been frustrated when each new development, which they imagine, held the promise of waking Cooper up from inside the life of Dougie Jones, but just as quick to come up with what they were sure was the next thing would, surely, do it this time. Coffee, case files, the American flag, hand-to-hand combat, sex, and cherry pie. So many hopes rested on the results of the Fusco brothers' fingerprint analysis, and yet, nope, tossed in the trash with a laugh because the information is just too incredible. As you addressed in your recap episode, this episode is the most blatant yet to show that the series is not being presented in a strictly linear fashion. Biggest offender being Bobby telling Ed he found some old stuff from his dad during their investigation today, despite that being multiple episodes ago now with several day-night cycles. Things have been moved around in the chronology. I suspect some of these were editing decisions based on where Lynch wanted certain moods and other beloved shots that didn't fit anywhere else, but he didn't want to leave on the cutting room floor. Cooper and Sonny Jim playing catch last episode. And the weird looping going on in the background of Sarah Palmer's scene may hint at some strange dimensional effects, but then again, it could just as easily be Lynch literalizing and personifying something in order to better convey the character's state of mind or how they feel about their life. He often does things like that, which later get interpreted to be the effects of some weird paranormal phenomenon. I always suspected Bob was originally just this, but that makes it more interesting as long as Frost doesn't get too literal with it. Let's go back to starting position. Starting position is more comfortable. Speaking of which, I guess the stuff with Ray and the ring means that Lynch is on board with somewhat reducing the ring's more complex and nuanced, or rather mysterious, nature in the film, in which it had both positive and negative aspects. Here, Ray is killed while wearing the ring. His soul is claimed by the Lodge. His corpse remains behind, though the ring does physically dematerialize and return. This would retroactively explain why Laura seems to be part of the Red Room crew now. I will remind everyone that Teresa was not wearing the ring when Leland bludgeoned her to death in possibly the Chalfont's trailer car in the film, and it's heavily implied that during this murder, Bob claimed the Garmin Bosia of a former ring wearer for himself, which infuriated Mike and contributed to his road rage incident with Leland and Laura as Philip Gerard shouting out about how Leland/Bob stole the corn. Fucking Walter. Aside from Andy and Lucy, it seems like none of the old residents of Twin Peaks are allowed to have had happy endings to their storylines from the original series when we meet them again. But the idea that the star-crossed love between Ed and Norma wouldn't hold just particularly stings. I am really with you on this one, Daniel. Fuck Walter. I think we're all there. He's a goofy Hank Jennings stand-in, in my opinion. But anyway, 25 years later, and James' song still has its power. It's both hilarious and puzzling why they didn't even bother to change the backup voices of Laura Flynn Boyle and Cheryl Lee from the original recording. It's literally the exact same recording. Everyone on stage is just lip syncing.
I didn't even think of that about the background vocals.
At least they got two brunettes to do it, you know. It would have been weird if it was like Candy, Mandy, and Sandy up there, you know.
No, that would have been better.
Right.
Okay, all right, in its own weird way, but all right, fuck. It was good to have Bad Dale back for a bit, and I, for one, can't wait to see what becomes of Richard's arrival at the farm. Oh, what misadventures the pair could have. Hey, apparently I'm not allowed to have nice things in my Twin Peaks right now, like Ed and Norma, so go ahead and give me more of that ultraviolence and nihilism. Let's go back to starting position. Starting position is more comfortable, don't you think so, Daniel?
Awesome feedback.
Daniel, I knew that you were going to like this episode, if for no other reason than the extended scene with Mr. C, because how many times you mentioned that you just want to see him be a badass on screen for a little while longer, and we all got that. This was my favorite Mr. C stuff by far.
Oh, yeah.
And you're right. It really does sting that Ed and Norma are not together at this point.
There are some things in Twin Peaks that feel punishing, almost deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely James Hurley on stage. That was on purpose punishing.
Poor James.
Hey, he signed up for this.
That's it. I thought it was going to be his only lines, if we're lucky.
That's a good question. Yeah, if we're lucky, that might be it.
Probably no. Not, because whatever's going on with this Renee chick, there's going to be more to it than that.
I noticed rewatching it, she had a tattoo on her arm of like four numbers, but I couldn't get it focused on what they were while she was crying in the booth. It was like a four and a couple nines. It was just weird.
And then, yeah, and I saw there was like a daisy on her wrist too. Mm-hmm.
I think it was 8675309.
Oh, eight, yes, six, that's seven, right.
8675309.
That number just gets around.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you, Daniel. Up next.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Up next, we have Dougie Milford. And he says, "Hi, M. Stephen Paul. Here's an idea I've had that would probably be more comfortable in an episode of Doctor Who, but that might answer Steve's question about the relevance of it being Bobby's scenes that are being seen out of order. What if Charlie is the one who is causing the time loops or whatever it is that's going on in Twin Peaks? When Bobby found the Major's map, they agreed to follow it in 2 days on October 1st. Two episodes later, Hawk stated they were going there the day after tomorrow. Then another two episodes after that, Bobby states that they discovered the stuff that his dad had left for him today. Maybe Bobby was getting too close to discovering whatever is at Jack Rabbit's palace, so Charlie activated something that held him and his associates in September 29th, effectively putting an end to their story. Later, when Audrey starts to question who she really is, Charlie asks, "Are you going to quit playing games, or do I have to end your story too? Thanks, and keep up the great work." So,
what a cool theory.
Yeah, so that's like he's the wizard behind the curtain.
Yeah.
Exterminate. He's a so Charlie is a Dalek inside of his little, if we get an outside view of where him and Audrey are, it's a big old Dalek shell, and he's controlling. That's cool. That's a cool little theory. I like that.
Yeah,
because it does seem like it's taking forever in linear time and maybe non-linear time to get past a couple of days so they can get to Jack Rabbit's palace. What the hell is going on?
Is Charlie making souffles inside that Dalek?
eggs.
And is he using all the local organic ingredients that Norma would want him to?
Yes.
Organic, yes. Natural, and local.
That's a really creative and interesting idea, by the way, Dougie, to make Charlie the one in charge of everything, or responsible for time loops and things like that. I would.
Yeah, it's pretty genius.
How would that be possible? Like, what would he be manipulating exactly to cause that to happen? Would it be Audrey's own mind, or would it be something bigger than her, bigger than Twin Peaks?
I mean, there's no telling. It's pretty cool.
Thanks, Dougie.
Thank you, Dougie.
Up next is Nicholas. Nicholas says, "Hello, M. Stephen Paul. I've hit bottom. Spent precious moments of my life investigating the grammatical correctness of just you and I. Sadly, it checks out, which makes James' authorship of the song the least believable thing about Twin Peaks. More believable is that he hasn't managed to write another song in 25 years. So much for the alleged comforts of starting position."
Well, I mean, when you sing a song like that and it keeps making girls cry, why write a second one?
Well, I mean,
mastered,
you know,
the first one.
Vanilla Ice really never wrote another song besides... you know, his hit, right? I mean, he just kind of keeps reworking it every 10 years.
Exactly.
As interesting as Starting Position is regarding character statuses, viewers' feelings, and the ongoing question of, is it future or is it past, what grabbed my interest more tightly was the question of, really? Arm wrestling? Maybe it's more on the nose than we're used to. The whole Two Cooper saga can be seen as arm wrestling. That is, a proxy war between the arm and the doppelganger. Ooh, I like where this is going. Their ultimate agendas and the roles of other parties, for example, artists formerly known as Giant, Woodsman, are cryptic. But the immediate dispute is where Mr. C slash Bob and Coop ought to be right now. Arm Prime wants Mr. C dead to the world and back in the lodge along with Bob. Doppel Arm seems to want to preserve the current state of Cooper affairs. Mike and Arm Prime's facilitation of the Laura Coop meeting and the effort to get Coop out of the Red Room were sabotaged by Doppel Arm right at the start.
That's right.
A lot of what's happened since seems like Mike and Arm Prime trying to regain some of that initially lost leverage in ways both useful, slot machine magic and cherry pie provision, and less useful, advice not to die.
Isn't that advice we all give?
Yeah.
Yes.
We all use and need.
Keep breathing. Operating through Philip Jeffries, I suspect they are the ones who got the ring into Ray's dumb pocket-emptying hands. Upon winning his skirmish, Mr. C sends the ring and part of Ray back to the lodge as a message to his foes, and maybe also as a snack for Doppel Arm via Ray's blood on the chevron floor, a la Leland's in Fire Walk With Me. Fortunately, Dougie Coop wins his own skirmish through an equal but opposite display of power that is interestingly transmitted through both his arms. Mr. C uses just one arm in his wrestling match, Death Blow, and gunshots. Dougie Coop's methods, even if superficially Mr. Magoo-ish, actually seem better suited to the conflict ahead. After all, the initial confrontation in episode 29 was based on fear slash courage and the integration slash disintegration rather than force. As a side note, rather than Mike's severed arm, I see the arm, the, as the entity that manages to transmit in and out of the lodge. His Let's Rock invites Cooper into his lodge accessing dream. His whooping is heard when electricity is used as a means of travel. He opens the curtain for Bob's exit from the lodge in Fire Walk With Me, and the two arms openly struggle over Coop's movement between worlds. Less directly, there are the electrical intrusions into people via arm movements slash seizures around the times of flow between worlds. Even the arms touching Mike Phillips' stump in Fire Walk With Me may be less a reconnection than his being a communication conduit between Lodger Bob and Outsider Mike, who at the time had turned in his lodge membership card. As trees, the evolved arms now have many limbs, perhaps indicating the lodge's expanded influence in our world. Man, that's a lot to chew on, but it's great.
Right, it's fantastic.
Non sequiturs. One, Ed and Nadine are both wearing wedding bands, but is Ed's marital martyrdom still necessary? Maybe that frame straightening sign is facing inside the gas farm for a reason. Straighten your frame, Ed. Still, I admire him pulling off eating soup with dignity. That's one of life's great challenges. Bookhouse boys don't slurp. Number two, with monitors, glass boxes, extraterrestrial movie screens, and this week's massive monitor, I think we are bringing that being. That's not being. Okay.
Being told?
Yeah. With monitors, glass boxes, extraterrestrial movie screens, and this week's massive monitor, I think we are being told that the return is viewed from multiple vantage points. Is this the simple explanation behind the time distortions?
I like that.
Plot flow gets choppy when switching perspectives takes narrative priority over temporal sequence. Or time dilation says that time moves differently for objects at two different vantage points. Although I think they have to be moving close to the speed of light. But nitpicking the laws of physics seems silly among so much weirdness.
Three. I'm just not capable of keeping up with something like that anyway.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I can go major in physics really quickly, and then we can get back to this discussion.
Yeah, we just need a Twin Peaks-style time loop where we can record that before we record it after. All right, non sequitur number three. File this under meaningless pairs. Sunny Jim now has a Sunny Jim. Ending position, Nick. P.S. Our viewing ritual starts with reassuring our two kids that mommy and daddy don't love Twin Peaks more than we love them, but that they had better go to bed now. Then I make a drink called the Red Room out of Aftershock and Diet Coke. Nicole inexplicably declines, and we settle in. We minimize the rewind interruptions by watching a second time with closed captioned a night or two later.
Nice. What is Aftershock?
I think it's like a cinnamon, whiskey? I don't know if it's a whiskey or a liqueur.
Ooh, mixing that with Diet Coke. Yeah.
Right?
And she inexplicably declines.
It probably has, you mix it together and it has that little cloud that goes over.
So, Nicholas, I like what you're saying about...
the arms.
The arms, for sure, mm-hmm. Yeah. And the whole arm wrestling and stuff coming into that, it's really cool. But I also like what you're saying about time being different at different vantage points. So, you know, M told me one time that they've actually done studies on children to where time actually does pass differently for them than it does adults, right?
Yeah, they've done studies on both adults and children, and they found that we do experience time differently. In fact, it's just so weird that you're bringing that up, because I just had this conversation with my boss today, because she also heard a similar thing on NPR this week. I've talked about this actually for a couple of years, but she was telling me, from what they were saying, it's the reason why we experience it differently is because we have a lot more data in our memory stores than young people do. So somehow that causes us to experience time moving faster than younger people.
Huh, that's really cool.
So if everything being the same for adults, you'd think like certain things like your state of mind and your mood and where you live would kind of go into that. So if you're if you're an old timer living in Twin Peaks and you're used to the rhythms of that kind of life, like Carl, right? Time is going to pass a certain way for him. It's going to pass very differently for somebody who's working in a casino in Las Vegas, I would imagine. So I know it's kind of a weird apples and oranges comparison kind of thing, but it could account for some of it. So when you come back to these other characters and you're looking at them and focusing on them, how does time pass for them? What's going on? What was their day comprised of? Mm-hmm. You know, how was
that's a really cool way to explain it too.
All right. Thank you, Nick.
Yes. Thank you, Nick. Up next, we have Adam. And Adam says, hey guys, as usual, great podcast. I agree with the other listener. I look forward to this cast almost as much as the actual show. Timelines are really just all over the place. I give up. I thought I had a rough estimate that two parts episodes equal about a day in Twin Peaks. That was until Bobby told Big Ed they found the stuff about his dad today. Ugh. Looks like the further we move along, the timelines continue to get more jacked up, much like I'm sure the story will too. James singing Just You with his love interest, looking on and crying, did harken back to Donna bawling at the Roadhouse in the original series, but also Betty crying at Club Silencio in Mulholland Drive. Who knew this song would stir up sadness after all this time, and not just because the song is so awful. Isn't it after they sang this in the original series when Bob crawled over the couch towards Maddie? I agree with M. I think there are several hints that we might lose someone important to us, or to Steve's point, several someones.
Mm-hmm.
I fully agree with Paul on what's happened to Audrey, but I think Charlie is her doctor and also her husband. If you haven't already, check out the movie Love and Mercy. It's about Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys and how his doctor took complete control of his life during therapy, isolating him from his family and at one point using him to make music. It's messed up and depressing, but it's totally the feeling I got here in this scene. If Charlie is messed up too, he may have forced her to marry him and is controlling her entire life, or as he mentioned, story. Maybe he's hoping, since she's a horn, he can get some money out of this marriage to update his home decor.
I mean, it would be money well spent.
It would be. P.S. This album was just released, Anthology Resource Volume 1 by Dean Hurley. It's all the ambient sounds and soundscapes in the series so far. Thanks. Oh, cool. Thank you.
Oh, wow.
Awesome. Yeah.
Nice. Thank you.
Yes. And if you guys are going to buy that through Amazon, you can click on our link first on our website at noship.net, and it won't cost you anything extra, but we'll get like a couple of pennies from that, and fantastic. That can help us financially support our podcast that way. It's funny that for a second there you said something about, what was it, if Charlie is messed up too, like as if he would be a patient as well, and he's like the dominant bully psych patient, and he's somehow taken over Audrey's weak mind.
Right, they got married in the hospital and they gave him like a room.
Where's Nurse Ratched?
Yeah, right.
So with the part where you're saying James singing Just You with his love interest looking on and crying, you know, it started making me think a little bit about this whole situation. If that is his love interest, which we're assuming that it is, she has every reason in the world to cry. This guy is just unreliable when you get right down to it. Like, what is the story behind when she says, James, how did you come up with that song? It's just so beautiful. It made me cry. And he's going to go, check it out. I wrote it right after my girlfriend died. But I was actually in love with her best friend. But then as I was singing the song, I fell in love with her cousin. It was the right. coolest thing ever. And she, as she's walking away, where are you going? Where are you going? Do you want me to sing it to you? All right. Thank you, Adam.
Thanks, Adam.
Up next is Nicole. Nicole says, hi, ESP. Just thinking about your observations from part 13 on all the repetitions and recursive loops in the return. Could these be examples of what Feedbacker Curtis was talking about with the concept of eternal recurrence? Wonder if these recursive loops are glitches in the matrix, reflecting the imbalance created with both Coop and his doppelganger simultaneously out in this world. One or the other needs to go back into the lodge, or as Feedbacker Nick says, they have to integrate. With regard to whatever is going on between Dr. Amp and Nadine and shoveling out of the shit, I noticed the medical report by Dr. Jacoby after Ed accidentally shot Nadine in the eye. Isn't that Mr. C's signature move now? Only his is a kill shot, but maybe that's what Ed was going for, and he just didn't quite get it.
It was an accident.
In the secret history of Twin Peaks, he writes, wow, patient is really whacked out, poor thing. I mean, she is hip deep in the shit. Great call, Nicole. Great call.
Right. Excellent.
It's interesting that it comes right after the scene where Big Ed makes his first appearance this season. Where Nadine is shoveling herself out and seems to have made a lovely life for herself, Big Ed merely shovels double R to go soup into his mouth as he sits hip deep in the shit of despair, aww, loneliness, and regret. Ah, poor Big Ed. Thanks again for all the recap and feedback and fun, Nicole.
Great catch.
Yeah, that absolutely is a really good catch. That would have been cool if he referenced that too. And I know it wouldn't be in the script because the script and the book were probably getting done somewhat simultaneously, mm-hmm, I guess. But
you know, we didn't get too much of Twin Peaks prior to Dougie being pulled into the lodge. So it's hard to compare the glitches, right? Because what did all we have was Dr. Jacoby getting his shovels prior to that?
As far as stuff in Twin Peaks proper?
Yeah.
Did we maybe have a scene with Ben and Jerry too?
Yeah, we did.
But there was nothing weird about that. I mean, aside from the obvious weirdness of them being Ben and Jerry Horn.
It's definitely something to look into.
But yeah, I like the idea that these glitches didn't start happening until we have this imbalance. Mm-hmm. And so, and then that brings us back to a previous Feedbacker talking about harmony, how we need to get back to that harmony.
Well, plus the fever pitch of whatever else has been going on too, you know, with all that girl in the car and everything else, everything bad that seems to be going on in Twin Peaks, it's just all coming to the boil and now the glitches. So it's just steadily getting worse.
It's crazy when you bring stuff like that up because I have to go, oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. Oh, God, how long ago was that? Did that happen?
I know.
Almost feels like it was a dream.
Crazy.
All right, up next, we have Paul and Wei. Wei and Paul. Hello, Team Sparklewood. Did you hear about the buzziest new sitcom coming out this fall? It's called Kindergarten Coop. And if they even put a trademark symbol right next to it, which is awesome. And it follows the misadventures of a hapless demon doppelganger with a penchant for black leather and overdoing it with the spray tans. He, along with his merry gang of slack-jawed sidekicks, spend their time reenacting scenes from Over the Top while watching the musical stylings of James Hurley on their farm-sized flat screen. Fun times and hilarious hijinks abound.
It's not a Koopa.
Yeah, right? That's awesome.
Now back to our regularly scheduled feedback. If last week's episode was about the relationship of father and son, this episode is very much about recurring events, or as Kindergarten Coop said, let's go back to starting positions. On the surface of this episode, we see Norma, Becky, Sarah Palmer, and even Ed engage in a cycle of self-defeating or self-destructive behavior. Norma and Big Ed continue their missed relationship while Walter saunters in and sweeps Norma off her feet, much in the same way Hank did back in their high school days. It feels like Walter, whose slimy demeanor is taking advantage of Norma's naivete, and after all these years, Norma is still attracted to a smooth talker because Ed is otherwise committed. Becky worries about her train wreck of a husband, as I'm sure she's done countless times before, and not unlike Shelley, who probably did the same at her age with Leo. Lastly, Sarah Palmer self-medicates herself with alcohol, her version of haloperidol, and what we surmise as her efforts to keep her past horrors and the spirits at bay. Each of them are at varying points of discomfort and pain, much like Doppelkoop's references of being uncomfortable during his arm wrestling match with Renzo, but each wants to get back to the starting position where things are neutral and stable and they can feel hope and possibly control over their situation. Also, I don't know about you guys, but other than Andy and Lucy, the Bookhouse Boys and the ladies of Twin Peaks have the worst luck with affairs of the heart.
Very true.
Right.
I like this idea of starting positions because, I just know as I get older and the world starts to wear on you in various ways, family dying, jobs and bills and all that stuff, starting position always seems so much nicer. You know what I mean?
Right.
So,
absolutely.
I could see this really jives with me right now, what Paul and Wei are saying here. Below the surface of it all is the disruption of time. We are privy to repeated days, and it seems the closer we get to October 2nd, the more they occur. These slips in time are an escalation of the town's climate, which is directly connected to the major event we think will happen when they reach Jack Rabbit's palace. In this episode, the biggest example of the time slip occurs in the ending scene with Big Ed. He sees his reflection acting independently of him in the window of his shop. As he sees this, an ominous sound filling the shop can be heard. At this time, Ed pauses, seems to mentally reset, and then proceeds as if nothing happened. Speaking of reflections, we notice that Charlie's reflection in the window behind him disappears once Audrey sits down in the chair facing him. I didn't even catch that. Jesus.
Right. I feel like I need to go and rewatch this entire episode.
I mean, I noticed Audrey and I focused on that reflection of Audrey, but I didn't even think about Charlie disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
Could time and space be jostled here by what is happening in the woods? The scene is taking place in a time-displaced living room, which adds to the confusion of the situation. This, unlike Ed's example, is not a return to a starting position, but rather a scene that is lost in time, which is the cause of Audrey's distress. She does not feel like who she is supposed to be, which speaks to the disruption that is occurring on a metaphysical level. All of this in line with our shattered windshield theory, or John Bernardi's timequake theory. It's possible that these time slips are caused by ripples from multiple worlds or realms converging. We are definitely a house divided on that James Hurley performance of Just You. This Paul thinks this performance happened on the same night as the Nine Inch Nails, and he probably opened for them since the same MC introduced both acts. While this Paul squealed like a little, like a schoolgirl at the sight of James sitting on stage at the Roadhouse, Way's ears were bleeding with revulsion. Nothing good has ever come from James performing this song. We recall that back in the original show, Maddie was menaced by Bob after this song played, which is why she is confident people are definitely going to die because of it. The next victim of James singing could be anyone. Lastly, we want to declare our solidarity with Sparkle Paul on the island of Diane. We still believe in Diane, even if others in the show like Cole and Denise may not trust her. We felt that Doppelkoop wouldn't need Ray if he can also get the coordinates from Diane. The fact that he doesn't get them from her vindicates Diane, in our view. Hashtag Team Diane. As always, your obliged and obedient servants, Wei and Paul. Thank you, nice. Wei and Paul. Great feedback as always.
Yeah, excellent. I'm going to have to go back and rewatch that scene to see if his image disappears. I mean, and then I like the theory. It's like the opposite end of the one that I had of them being kind of stuck. It's really cool.
Well, I also want to go back and see Diane's reflection now when she first meets Mr. C, or mm-hmm. and then not first meets him, but first faces him. And then also we had Richard Horn in Miriam's door, his reflection. Yeah. So maybe there's something going on with those reflections too.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point.
Or maybe they were there to kind of catch your eye and kind of set the stage for you to, or to prep you to keep an eye out for them in some way, mm-hmm. calibrate you toward them.
That's really good.
I like how you're Sparkle Paul.
Yeah, me too.
Hey, I'm good with that. Could be worse.
So, Wei and Paul, we're going to need you to do something a little bit different next week. Go ahead and write in your feedback as usual, but make sure you get it to us before we do our recap so we can just, you know, work off of that instead of doing a recap, because you guys just really nail it. So,
I mean,
it would just help us out. Just kidding.
All night long, we've had such fantastic feedback. It's hard to find something to say because it's like the work needs to speak for itself. It's really fantastic. Like one after another has been excellent tonight. So kudos to everybody for writing in such fantastic feedback.
I really like the touch of trademarking Kindergarten Coop.
Yeah, me too.
Right? Right.
Thank you, guys.
I don't think too many kindergartens survive that class.
No.
Oh, God, no.
Nursery school. Up next is John Bernardi. John says, "Hey there, Eagle Scouts. I know I was poking fun at the arm wrestling in my sound file, and I was laughing to myself as I made up that scenario while watching it for the first time because it's so on point with the way all the other scenes luxuriate. But by the middle of the actual match, I was riveted. So much more intense than it had any right to be. As far as to the question of what's the point of all the time being out of order, I'm a huge Vonnegut nut. And also the only book I've ever finished writing was Unnecessarily Told Out of Order." Unnecessarily, huh? "So it feels instinctually correct to me that you can group scenes by tone and topic rather than plot. This week was about being stuck in a cycle you can't get out of. The week before was a paternalism theme. There was one part focusing on domestic violence, one on friendship. As this show seems to explore the human condition, I feel like every episode explores a part of that condition as Cooper learns his way through his current situation on his way to rebirth or ascension or whatever he'll be at the climactic point of the return. So the actual plot points and chronology is less important to this series than the state of being and coexisting. Does that work as a good possible explanation for you? Take care, John." Yes, it does. For myself, I can definitely say that that works. If you're saying that you can look at each episode as a theme, and then we run the characters through different situations in that theme, but they're not too on the nose. They're mm-hmm. there, and they're somewhat obvious, but they're still retaining subtlety. Then yes, I completely agree with that, and I like that idea because that way, every last little scene doesn't have to make perfect sense when matched up against every other scene. We can take the gist of things, the meaning, the emotional intent behind a particular scene, and group it with others of a like mind. And then it mm-hmm. flows much better that way rather than just having it be very detail-oriented and nitpicky and say, well, this couldn't have happened before here and this and that. So to me, that works very, very well, and I like that idea, John.
It's the reason we've been waiting for on why they would do that. You know, we've said it, like, why would they do this? And it fits really well. I like it myself.
It's like seeing the trees for the forest, or maybe more like the Douglas firs and the spruce and the pines. Right?
The sycamores.
And the redmore. And the sycamores and the redwoods right. for, the, it's really for good. The forest. And I was also riveted by that match, too, because I was like, really? Arm wrestling? And then once we were in, I was like, of course it's going to be awesome. Why yes. was I even scoffing at it to begin with? I should know better.
Yeah, he almost shamed me the same way. Like, oh, shame on you for thinking this is going to be stupid. You're going to love it.
Thank you, John. This up next is our final piece of feedback, and this is from Mark. And Mark says, "Regarding the time debate, given the evidence, I had to rethink it. The sequence of events is not completely linear, but I have a theory that may attempt to explain it. Please bear with me," which he wrote in quotes. Which, you know, I didn't mention this, but I thought about that bear with me as Lynch and Frost saying, come on, just hang in there, guys. This is all going to make sense. This is our message to you.
Bear with us as we give you another slow, excruciating scene of somebody not talking. But you love it anyway.
Mark says, "So there I am sitting on my couch in front of my TV, finishing off a glass of bourbon, watching Sarah Palmer sit on her couch in front of her TV, finishing off a Bloody Mary, watching the looping boxing match, and I think, man, it feels like the Black Lodge is bleeding into my reality. Later, it hits me. Maybe that's why the narrative timeline seems to be slipping out of sequence. The Black Lodge, or the Zone, is bleeding into their reality. Because of Mr. C's trick, the barrier is breaking down, especially around certain places and people like the Palmer House, or Dougie, or Mr. C, or Twin Peaks in general. I think we can safely say that Lodge time doesn't play by the same rules. If that's the case, then Lodge time may affect the other dimension, creating glitches. The narrative thread unravels. If that's what's going on, then the endpoint of the larger narrative may be a complete breakdown of reality as we know it. Instead of neatly tying up the story, we could get total chaos. Part of me wants to see how crazy it can get. The other part of me wants to see Agent Cooper wake up and kick Mr. C's ass. To support this theory, refer to Bill Hastings' website. He writes, "We will have to reconcile with the question that if someone from outside our familiar world gains access to our plane of existence, what ramifications will that entail? There might be forces at work from deep dimensional space or from the future, or are these one and the same? Think of the events that could have splintered time, the things that could have laid the seed for a starting point for this development, perhaps technological innovations or the assassination of President Kennedy or the atomic bomb in 1945. Mm-hmm. One last thing, when Charlie says to Audrey, now are you going to stop playing games or do I have to end your story too? I think my brain melted. It's hard to process. Is it meta? A coma? Is she stuck in the lodge? Is she mentally ill or brain damaged from being in a coma? Fuck. So great. I love it.
What's your damage, Audrey?
Mark, I actually really favor your idea of what's happening with time with the lodge bleeding in. And we really haven't talked about what, because somebody asked earlier in our feedback, what is Mr. C's end goal with these coordinates? And maybe he is, that those coordinates are necessary to allow the lodge to fully encompass reality.
Nice to like help facilitate everything just kind of like go awry. I like it.
I mean, because at first we're just led to believe that he's just trying not to get pulled back in, but that could just be a minor thing he's having to deal with. And he's got a bigger plan at play that we really haven't talked about.
Mm-hmm. Like if that did all spill over, would he kind of be in charge because of Bob and who he is? Like, would he have more power?
I would guess if that's his end goal, then yeah. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, why would he do it? Because I mean, he's pretty powerful without the lodge being involved in reality.
Here's or maybe a way to bring the mother into reality.
Or maybe he wants to prevent it because he is powerful without the lodge being.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. You know, the coordinates are leading him back to Twin Peaks, and there's a big, you know, for lack of a better term, entryway or hellmouth into the lodges from there, right? So what if he's doing something that could close it forever? What if he needs to get to that point now that he's out and he's managed to stay out and he's trying to do something that is going to make sure that like they can never pull him back in? Like just shut the blast door barrier down, kind of.
If he does that, does that make him kind of a good guy?
No.
But he stops whatever the lodge is doing to town, though. You know what I mean? They would stop all these bad things happening to Twin Peaks.
True, but you
and
can argue
for the lodge from taking over the world.
Does Cersei become a good guy if she helps you fight the Night King?
Kinda.
But you have to look at it from this point of view too. Cooper. Mr. C could be viewed as somewhat heroic for doing that and helping out and stopping all of the stuff that's going on. But he's responsible for it in the first place by staying out of the lodge when he was supposed to be brought back in.
Yes.
So if we can attribute all that to him, really he's just cleaning up his own diapers
his
here.
Oh, mess. Okay.
You know?
Okay.
Well,
he
needs Cooper to go into the lodge so it can bring it back to the way it was. It's the fact that both of them are on the outside.
Right, but Cooper's supposed to be on the outside and he's supposed to be on the inside. So his insistence on still living he got 25 years, you know? He got a good amount of time to go. And he came, and that's a long time when you think about it, because he came out fully formed and like adult, able to execute all of his will and desire. So he didn't have to like grow up and become a 25-year-old. He was already, you know, in a body that was older than that and stuff like that. So it's, you know, it's just like in kindergarten when you get taught to clean up your own blocks. So
go put your toys up.
Yeah. Kindergarten Coop. All right. So that does it for the No Ship Network Feedback Podcast for Twin Peaks The Return, Part 13. Stay tuned. Part 14 is going to be here before you know it. We are barreling towards the end of this show. Unfortunately, we all want to get to the end, but we don't want to get to the end. You know how it is. So thank you for joining us. This has been a No Ship Network Podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
Sparkle Paul out.